Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Does the Upper Peninsula of Michigan seem creepy to you? You might think so after reading Karen Dion's novels. Her latest two psychological thrillers are set in the UP, and a third one is in the works. Karen's best known for her novel The Marsh King's Daughter, which has been translated into 25 languages. Her latest book is The Wicked Sister. Karen appeared at a virtual National Writer Series event and spoke with Cynthia Canty, former host of Michigan Public Radio's Stateside. Cynthia asked Karen to tell her about her new book.
Well, like The Marsh King's Daughter, The Wicked Sister takes place in Michigan's Upper Peninsula wilderness. And it's the story of a young woman named Rachel Cunningham, who in her early years, she grows up in a beautiful log cabin surrounded by 4,000 pristine acres of wilderness southwest of Marquette. And this cabin, if you want to call it that, it's more like a mansion. It's just over the top. It has a copper roof, stained glass windows. It has Tiffany lamps, Navajo blankets, Oriental rugs. So Rachel's parents are wildlife biologists. Her father studies the amphibians on the property, and her mother studies black bears. And so Rachel grows up, you know, following them around in the woods. She has a real affinity for all living creatures, but especially black bears, so much so that even when she's an adult, she feels like she can communicate with bears on a deeper, almost a spiritual level. Mm-hmm. But the book does not begin with Rachel happily following her mother around in the woods. Instead, she's in a mental hospital. And she's been there for 15 years by her own choice because she believes that she is responsible for the terrible shooting accident that took the lives of both her parents when she was 11. And then, you know, she finds out fairly early on in the novel that she couldn't have done this, and she goes back to her childhood home to figure it all out.
To see what happens. What planted the seed for this story, the story of these, of the family and the sisters? Was there a person? Was there some event?
Well, both my novels feature characters that have a tragedy or trauma in their childhood that they have to overcome. That seems to be a recurring theme for me. It's always been something that I've wondered about. You know, you read about somebody who maybe they were abused, but they grow up and they adopt children and take care of them in foster care, and they all get PhDs. And I used to think, how does this happen? How can you not be defined by your childhood? So the core beginning for Rachel's character in The Wicked Sister is many years ago, I read about a little boy, a toddler really, who was sitting behind his mother in the car, strapped into his car seat. He found a loaded handgun in her purse, shot and killed her. So, you know, horrific, horrific thing. Right. But of course, he had no knowledge of what he was doing. And yet I knew that at some point that little boy was going to grow up and he was going to find out what he did. So how would that knowledge change him? How could you go forward knowing that even, you know, though you were an innocent child that did not know what you were doing, you still took your own mother's life? How can you not let that define you? So those are the types of questions that I'm exploring with Rachel's character.
The idea of exploring the relationship between sisters intrigued me. I am the only girl. I had two younger brothers. But somehow having a wicked brother doesn't seem to pack the same punch. Do you have a sister or sisters?
I have two sisters. I'm the black sheep, the one in the middle.
And what did they think when they read this?
I think they think I'm the wicked sister of the title.
Well, would you read us a little of the opening of The Wicked Sister? Give everyone a taste of how and where Rachel's story begins.
I sure will. So the first chapter is in Rachel's voice, and she says, "Sometimes when I close my eyes, there is a rifle in my hands. My hands are small. My fingers are pudgy. I'm 11 years old. There's nothing special about this particular rifle, nothing to distinguish it from any other Remington, except that this is the rifle that killed my mother. In my vision, I am standing over my mother. The rifle is pointing at her chest. Her mouth is open and her eyes are closed. Her chest is red. My father runs into the front hallway. Rachel, he screams when he sees me. He drops to his knees, gathers my mother in his arms, looks up at me, his expression an unfamiliar jumble of shock and horror. He rocks my mother for a long time as if she is a baby, as if she is alive. At last, he lays her gently on the worn parquet floor and gets slowly to his feet. He takes the rifle from my trembling hands and looks at me with a sorrow greater than I can comprehend and turns the rifle on himself. Not so, says the golden orb spider from the middle of her web in a corner of my room where the cleaners never sleep. Your father killed your mother, and then he killed himself. I don't understand why the spider is lying. Spiders normally tell the truth. How do you know? I can't resist asking. She wasn't there when my parents died. I was. The spider regards me solemnly from 8 shiny eyes. I know, she says. We all know. Her spiderlings skitter about the edges of the web as insubstantial as dust motes and nod. The police ruled my parents' death a murder-suicide perpetrated by my father. All the news reports I've been able to find agree. Peter James Cunningham, age 45, murdered his wife, Jennifer Marie Cunningham, age 43, for undetermined reasons, and then turned the rifle on himself. Some speculate that I saw my father shoot my mother, and that's why I ran away. Others, that I found my parents' bodies, and this is what sent me over the edge. I would have told them that I was responsible if I had been able to speak. When I came out of my catatonia 3 weeks later, I made sure that everyone who would listen knew what I had done. But to this day, no one believes me, not even the spider.
Not even the spider. Now, Karen, you let yourself take a little poetic license in putting Rachel in the Newberry Regional Mental Health Center. Talk a little about that decision and that place, why Newberry was the right place to launch this story.
Well, when we moved to the Upper Peninsula, my husband and I, the psychiatric facility was still in operation. And we even knew someone that was receiving treatment there briefly. So I've been inside. And the thing is, it defines the whole town. It's what made Newberry, a town for a long time. And it's been closed for many years. In fact, if you go to some of those places, websites for abandoned places, you can see pictures of the mental hospital, as we called it, in disrepair. But now it's a medium security prison. So I put a note in the beginning of the book, acknowledging that I'm playing a little fast and loose with history here. But, the hospital was such a defining part of Newberry as the town as I knew it, that I wanted to put it in the story.
Oh, it's a great place. Yeah. It is a great place to start. What came first, do you think? The Upper Peninsula of Michigan, we know, is extremely important to your storytelling. We saw it in The Marsh King's Daughter, and now we see it in The Wicked Sister. And we have a lot of people asking about your attachment to the Upper Peninsula. We're going to talk about your experience living there, but it's an important character in your story. How would you describe the Upper Peninsula as a character in The Wicked Sister?
Well, The Marsh King's Daughter focused on the wetlands or the marsh of the Tequamenon River Valley. So this time I've shifted it to the forest, for The Wicked Sister. And one of the things I love about the setting is both my books have a fairy tale element to them as well. And so by creating this beautiful log cabin over the top mansion in the middle of this acreage.
That I wanted to go to stay at immediately, by the way you described it. It's like, please let that be a place I want to go visit.
Yeah. So it's like a castle in a forest, and it has that air of mystery about it that I really enjoy. But for me personally, anytime I write a book now that's set in the Upper Peninsula, it's almost like writing a memoir because, I lived there for so long. And as I'm writing, I might put a detail in my story and think to myself, I never would have found that no matter how much I research, because I just know these things.
You lived it. And so let's go to that. You have lived the life. It isn't just that you're a diligent researcher. Tell us how you, your husband, and your, 6-week-old daughter wound up living in a tent deep in the Upper Peninsula woods. When was that, and why'd you do it?
Back in the early 70s, my husband and I were a newly married couple living in the Detroit area. My husband was a stoneware potter, and we traveled around to art shows selling his pottery, and that's how we made our living. But we were not alone in wanting to feel closer to nature. That was the main thing. For us as young people, the idea of working at your job all week long and then collecting your paycheck, and then you go to the store and you buy the food, we thought to ourselves, why can't we just grow our own food. Of course, how we ended up in the Upper Peninsula, you're never going to sustain yourself growing your own food there. It's far too cold. Tomatoes don't even get ripe. But we had dreams, and so did a lot of other young people. So we bought 10 acres. And, you know, the pregnancy wasn't planned, but we just sort of slid her into what we were doing. So, yeah.
And I guess, how much knowledge did you bring to this experience? Or was it just the school of hard knocks? I mean, you built, how'd you do that?
We just learned as we went. Actually, though, there was a book series called the Foxfire series. Mm-hmm. And this is where teenagers were interviewing their elders. I believe it was in Tennessee. And so things like how to split shakes, cedar shakes from a log, and different things we learned from that book. We didn't really go the whole hog with, you know, like making our own soap and so forth, because, you know, you can go to the grocery store and buy soap. But we had a lot of fun trying out these different things. And no, my husband didn't have any particular construction experience, so I think he did a fantastic job with that cabin.
He did. How far, where were you, and where, how far were you from the nearest town?
Well, this is the thing. So the cabin was right on M28, which is the main east-west highway in the Upper Peninsula, because we planned to open a pottery studio there and, you know, catch the tourists going by. So while we were not as remote as the stories that I write, still, you know, we didn't have running water for the first 2 years. We carried our water from a stream and used an outhouse, you know, behind the cabin there. And so I wrote the cabin into my novel, The Marsh King's Daughter. This is my little Easter egg that writers think of it as. So there's a section in The Marsh King's Daughter where Helena, the main character, is imagining how her father escaped from prison. He escaped during a prison transfer between Newberry and Marquette. And so she's picturing him planning his moment. And I say, you know, they drove past the turnoff to Engadine, past Four Corners, up a hill, through the tiny town of McMillan, down a hill, up another hill, past the McGinnis farm, those were friends of ours, mm-hmm. down another hill, across Kings Creek, up a hill, past the abandoned pottery studio and cabin built by a hippie couple in the 1970s.
And there you were. You took a little
there we were.
As you did that. I am, Karen, forever intrigued by all the different paths that people take to find their way to what it is they're meant to be doing. What did you love to read when you were growing up?
Oh, everything. I read everything on my parents' bookshelves, even books that were probably not age appropriate, you know, for an 8 or a 9 year old child. Just everything. When I was a young married person, I guess I liked science-based books, like what Michael Crichton wrote. And so when I decided I was going to, you know, take writing seriously about 20 years ago, my early novels were science-based thrillers, similar to what Michael Crichton writes. And the first one was set in Antarctica, and the next one was set at Chaitén Volcano in northern Patagonia, Chile. So I was choosing what I thought of as exotic places, right? You know, mm-hmm. places I'd like to go to and travel. And so I do think it's interesting that, you know, the exotic place I'm writing about now is a place where I lived for 30 years. But The Marsh King's Daughter has been translated into 25 languages. And so people all over the world are reading about the UP as if, like I was, it's an exotic place.
Isn't that, it's that idea of write what you know, mm-hmm. write what you know to find that true voice. What, when and how did your love of reading, you know, thinking of all the things you were doing as a young mother and the jam making and the, you know, eking out this living kind of off the grid, how did this morph and evolve into writing?
Yeah. When I was in high school, I won creative writing awards in the Scholastic Art and Writing Award contest. So then I wasn't one of these people that was just compelled to always be writing. I did other creative things. Mm-hmm. I liked fiber arts and counter cross stitch and stained glass, and we built that cabin. So there was always something creative going on. And then when my son was in high school, when we were living in St. Ignace, he also is a talented writer. And so I was encouraging him to enter that same contest. And I thought, well, what about me? I used to be a good writer. And I'll tell you what really clinched it. So he did enter the contest. It happened to be the contest's 75th anniversary. So he won a Gold Key Award. The award ceremony was at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. Oh. Kathy Bates was the master of ceremony. Frank McCourt was the keynote speaker. And I'm like, we are going.
wild horses were not going to keep you away from that.
That's right. So I think that really clinched it, you know, and
it lit the spark.
Okay, I used to be a good writer. Let's see what I can do. So I spent about a year writing short stories, and then I decided to tackle a novel. That novel will never see the light of day, but it did get me my literary agent.
Did you turn to anyone to learn the craft of writing, or did you just figure it out?
I just figured it out. Wow. I do have to say my agent was a huge help, because that first novel, he signed me on as a client, even though my plotting was a mess, because he loved the premise of that book, and he felt that my writing was strong enough to pull it off with a rewrite. So I spent 3.5 years under his tutelage, rewriting the novel 3 times before we were both sick of it, said, this is as good as it's going to get. And, you know, so that one didn't sell, but then my next novel did. So I credit, if I had any school, any teacher, it was my literary agent, who I'm still with, by the way.
Well, there we go. What do you think drew you, Karen, to suspense and to thrillers?
I am a person who is, number one, easily bored. And also, I like noisy things. So, like, I played violin growing up, and I did play in string quartets, but right now, a string quartet would bore me to tears. Give me Beethoven with the cannons going off and this sort of thing. So yes, that's what drew me to thrillers. Psychological suspense is actually a little bit different, because it doesn't have that level of action that a true thriller does.
Because really, that's what psychological suspense would be.
Yes, that's what I'm reading now. Mm-hmm. Because that delves more deeply into, you know, the characters' relationships. And yes.
Mind and heart. Not screeching car tires and things going boom. I think it is such a big leap. I think to go from that idea that, gee, I want to write, writing maybe in workshops in kind of a cocoon, to saying to yourself, I'm a writer. I own this. This is what I am. How and when did you come to that point where you said, I own this?
That happened when my first novel sold. That's that outside validation that a writer needs. You know, every aspiring writer is writing on spec. And of course, there's going to be moments of self-doubt. You know, we're our own worst critics. But when my novel sold, came out in mass market paperback with Berkeley. That was the moment, and it changed me, you know, and I'm like, okay, now I am a writer. But I have to say, when I wrote The Marsh King's Daughter, I experienced the same sort of thing, because creatively and craft-wise, The Marsh King's Daughter was a big step up for me. My early stories are relatively simple. They don't have the complex complexity of The Marsh King's Daughter. They're not told in a dual timeline and so forth. So there were a lot of writing techniques that I tried out for the first time in The Marsh King's Daughter. So, you know, that in turn, you know, basically I found out I was a better writer than I realized, because, you know, I stepped up my game on that.
Karen, a lot of people might sit down, you know, at a keyboard, write something, put pen to paper, perhaps, but there are not many who can say without reservation that they have been published. They've achieved public recognition, national and international sales and praise. Exhibit A, The Marsh King's Daughter, published, as you mentioned, 25 languages, chosen as one of the best books of 2017 by newspapers, not just in the U.S. I saw the Irish Independent, which I love. That's one of my favorite papers when I'm in Ireland. Named one of the best books. How did that feel when you had achieved success with your baby, with your story, your ideas, your words, your work?
I pinched myself constantly. I still pinch myself, because when I got the idea to incorporate the fairy tale, I knew that the book had potential. But it's done massively better than I ever guessed. The reception for it has just been so outstanding. The thing that I, as a writer, really appreciate is, you know, the handful of awards that it's won, and, you know, a rave review in the New York Times, because that speaks to the quality of the writing. Because we know books can be bestsellers and they're not particularly well written. There's just something else about them that appeals to people. So, you know, for me, that recognition of the craft that went into the story was really gratifying.
And now that you have built a fan base, does that ease pressure, or does it maybe ratchet up pressure when you sit down to write another book?
Well, I did struggle writing The Wicked Sister. And the reason is because creatively, every time something wonderful happened for The Marsh King's Daughter, of course I was happy. But it was like a load on my shoulders, you know, weighing me down, because in my mind, I had to do this now again. These were the expectations. I myself set the bar very high. And it was a challenge at first. I struggled, but then finally I realized it's not my job as the author to compare my two books. Readers will do that. Reviewers will do that. My job was to make The Wicked Sister the best version of itself that it could be. And so, you know, once I adopted that mindset, you know, I've just focused on the one book, don't compare the two. It's like a parent has more than one child, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're not supposed to have favorites, right? So, yeah. And, you know, it's been interesting having the novel published now, you know, in the middle of the shutdowns, because, you know, there's a lot of changes for I and all authors. And it's not just that we can't go on tour, but like some of the magazines, they're short staffed, you know, the staff are working from home. So reviews aren't coming in at the same pace. Nothing's the same in publishing right now. And bookstore owners in particular, oh my goodness, they worked so hard to just like in a moment flip from a walk-in store to, you know, a store that made their living online. So yeah. It's been a real interesting experience, including and up to talking to you right now.
That we're not on the stage right now at the Opera House, but still indeed. Now, are you, I understand, working on your next book? Can you give us a few teases?
I am. I had every intention, you know, The Wicked Sister took a little longer than I wanted it to. And so I was going to take a nice break. And then about 2 weeks before I was finished with The Wicked Sister, I got the idea for the next one. So I just sort of put that on the back burner until I could address it. So my third psychological suspense is also going to take place in the Upper Peninsula.
We're noticing a lot of the folks joining us tonight are noticing this theme, delighted with this.
I'm not done with it yet. So the first book was set in the wetlands or the marsh. Wicked Sister is set in the forest. This time I'm bringing in the Great Lakes. Because, you know, Michigan, Great Lakes,
yes.
We're surrounded by four of the five. You know, the lakes are a huge part of our life in the Upper Peninsula. Book three is set in Grand Marais, which is, you know, a tiny little town on the shore of Lake Superior. And I hope to make the lake a character, just like the marsh and the forest. So I'm going to have to really, you know, stretch, because I'm not a sailor, but I'll get out there on the water, and, you know, I've been there. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, the section of shoreline between Grand Marais and Whitefish Point is also known as the graveyard of the Great Lakes. And that's where the Edmund Fitzgerald went down that Gordon Lightfoot sang about. So that might give a little hint as to some of the story events in book three.
I already can't wait to talk to you about that. Mm-hmm. Both The Marsh King's Daughter and this new one, The Wicked Sister, are stories I would love to see as films or a really well done limited series, like on premium cable or, you know, Amazon or Netflix. I'd love to see these, because I was casting them in my mind as I was reading them. Can you give us a sense of how far along either one might be in this direction?
Well, The Marsh King's Daughter has been optioned. Mm-hmm. And this has been a couple of years now that it's been optioned. The production company that optioned the rights are responsible for the movie The Imitation Game with Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And the screenwriter who adapted my novel, he wrote the screenplay for the movie The Revenant with DiCaprio.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I was pretty
good pedigree.
Yes. I was pretty excited about that, because when I was writing The Marsh King's Daughter, I did not think movie for a second, not 1 second. When my agent sent the manuscript to editors to see if anyone wanted to publish it, he sent me an email and he said, oh, by the way, you also have a film agent. And honestly, I thought, I guess it could be a movie. I just didn't see it that way. But of course, you know, I'm really thrilled that, you know, the people who are associated with it, Oscar nominees, Oscar winning talent. We've had four directors and two actresses attached to the project so far, which I'm told is absolutely typical. I wish I could name the current actress, but they haven't announced it, so it's not my news to share. But and then I do know things are on hold in Hollywood, you know.
Yes, altogether. Sure.
So, you know, no movement recently, but it certainly would be pretty amazing. is even amazing just to think that these talented, talented people want to bring my story to the screen.
Well, I'm there for watching it. I have to ask, what do you find to be the best, most satisfying thing about being a writer?
I really enjoy creating, the act of creating. Mm-hmm. And I think writing is creative on so many levels. You're creating people, you're creating characters, and you're creating situations, you know, for the characters to have to deal with. Through the descriptions, you're creating an actual world, you know, that the reader is going to read about one day. So, and then even on a paragraph level, on a sentence level, you know, there are always these decisions, you know, am I going to use a one syllable adjective in this sentence or a two syllable adjective? Is the sentence going to end on a hard or a soft note? So it's just such a deeply creative process. I think that's what appeals to me most about writing.
Well, I have to tell you, I love this. You did keep me up at night. I couldn't put it down. And I want to thank you, Karen Dion, for spending time with us tonight, because it was such a treat to meet you. And I'm glad we had this way of gathering, but let's all look forward to a point in the future we can once again gather on that beautiful Opera House stage in downtown Traverse City, and we will be doing it in person.
I couldn't have put it more eloquently. Thank you very much for having me.
That was Karen Dion talking with Cynthia Canty, and you're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up in the second half, a discussion with thriller writer Brad Thor.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Brad Thor calls his novels faction. He does meticulous research to add real-life details to his books so you can't tell where the fact ends and the fiction begins. Brad has written 20 thrillers, and his latest is Near Dark. He talked with me during a virtual National Writer Series event, and I asked Brad to talk about his new book.
If Near Dark was a movie, and by the way, I've done 20 thrillers, but I say my books are like the James Bond movies. You don't have to have seen any of them to jump right into the latest one. So in this one, the log line for the movie poster would be the world's largest bounty has just been put on the head of America's top spy. Scott Harvath is my recurring protagonist, and he is probably at the lowest point he's ever been professionally, personally. He's down in Key West, and he's spending most of his time behind a bottle of bourbon, not sure if he wants to go on either with his career or his life. And so it's a very dark, very low moment, and that's where the book starts. But the action kicks in almost immediately.
It does, and we find him in Backlash, the previous novel, having lost dear things. Talk about that just a moment.
Yeah, so a lot happened in Backlash, and one of the things, and it's in the jacket copy for Near Dark, so I'm not giving away any spoilers, one of the people that he lost was his new wife. And there are two things that Harvath always wanted in life. He wanted to serve his country, and he wanted to have a family of his own. And it made for interesting tension in the novels because he was never home. He kept grabbing for the most dangerous assignments that were out there, and it created tension in his relationships. None of them lasted very long. And he finally found somebody who understood him and was willing to put up with that, his need to keep going downrange, that addiction to that lifestyle. And as soon as he put a ring on this woman's finger, she was gone. And so it seems like he's been denied the one thing he wanted most in life. And so he's given up. That's where the book opens up.
So Scott Horvath, with one T, named after your brother, I learned, mm-hmm. which is interesting. Harvath, I'm sorry, not Horvath.
and shot you the correction, huh?
He did, yeah. Yeah, usually a big hook, but anyway, he's born in 2002, essentially, and I was really curious. Let's just talk a moment about where the thriller genre sits right now in the middle of America, where it kind of sits in our consciousness. We've had a lot of them at NWS. We have a huge readership of the thriller genre. But 9/11 had just happened, and I see that you published this book, Lions of Lucerne, your first one in 2002. Just talk to us about how you chose Harvath.
Yeah, so it's a great question. So we actually had this stop the presses moment where we were, all the copy edits were done, the book was ready to go. It was slated to come out in January, right, so beginning of 2002, 9/11 happens. And in The Lions of Lucerne, there had been a discussion between characters about some of the biggest terrorist events that had happened. Well, we couldn't have a book come out post 9/11 and not mention 9/11. So we were lucky enough to be able to postpone the book, get it back from the printer, and put that in there, those references in there. And I think mine is probably the first thriller to come out post 9/11 to mention 9/11. The idea for Harvath and this kind of genre, or this piece of the thriller genre, this idea of one man kind of going and doing the things that need to be done, I think is something that we, as citizens in a civilized society, we respect the rule of law, we respect people who are guided by a moral compass and things like this, but I think inherently we all understand that some of the worst actors out there are not signers of the Geneva and Hague Conventions. They're not going to show up on the battlefield with so much as an armband to designate themselves as combatants. They hide behind women and children, they ambush our soldiers and things like this. So I think we all want to believe that there's guys like Scott Harvath out there willing to bend and break some of the rules in order to protect the rest of us. I'm fond of saying, Doug, that there can be no American dream without those willing to fight and defend it. You can't be an author. I can't be an author. We can't enjoy the comfort and safety of our own homes and things like this without these brave men and women who carry out some of this nation's most dangerous business. So that's a constant theme I have going in my thrillers, which is that okay? Is it okay for us to not abide by our own sets of rules all the time? When is it okay to bend or break a rule? There is a reason everybody loved Kiefer Sutherland as Jack Bauer in the 24 series, because, you know, we saw the ticking clock, you know, the digital clock counting down, and we knew something bad was going to happen, but for Jack Bauer, because he was going to shortcut if he had to get there and worry about the repercussions later. So that's always been an underlying source of tension, Harvath and his superiors and things like this. And that question of what does it mean to send someone like him into the field and to allow him, kind of with a wink, we're going to look the other way, because you know he's got a good moral compass. He's not going to break the rules because he's a sadist. He's going to break the rules because it's necessary. But he's also going to provide his superiors with a certain degree of plausible deniability, so they can't say we sent him out there to break the rules. He's going to end up taking the fall, but he's willing to do that because he thinks that's what's necessary.
Yeah. So it's interesting, Brad. In 1992, you graduate from USC and you studied with someone that I met at Iowa, T.C. Boyle.
I was going to ask if you had met Tom at Iowa.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine a more different person than Tom Boyle and Scott Harvath, but it's interesting. I want to talk a moment about just your metamorphosis. You grew up in Chicago. Your father had wanted you to be a business major at USC. You actually enrolled in that class. And I found it fascinating that apparently during an econ lecture, you stood up and left.
I did.
Talk about that moment, because I think we want to talk about your own evolution.
Yeah, so it was an econ class, a lovely professor. He came in practically shaking. He was so excited. It was Valentine's Day was coming up, and he said, I got a great project. you are a manager of 8 flower stores and you have X amount of roses ordered for Valentine's Day, but only so many vases, and everybody wants vases. And the guy was practically trembling. He thought this was such a great project for us. And I just closed the books and I'm like, I'm out of here. And my friend said, where are you going? Sitting next to me in the row in the auditorium. And I said, listen, I'd rather take a bullet between the eyes than be a middle manager in a flower store chain for the rest of my life. And they said, Brad, it's just an exercise. You don't have to go into the flower business. I said, this is deeper than the flower business. I'm not happy as a business major. And I ended up sulking for a couple of days. And one of my roommates, I wasn't going to class. And one of my roommates said, listen, go to the college counseling office. This is what they exist for. They're going to help you. And I went in and they administered something. The name has changed now, but back then it was called the Strong Campbell Personality Test. And what they do is they compare your likes and interests with people who are satisfied and fulfilled in different careers. It could be bakers, morticians, whatever it is. And I scored off the charts for writing and publishing. Didn't necessarily mean I'd be any good at it, but it meant that that was an area where I could probably find fulfillment. So I went to the registrar's office and said, can I switch my major without declaring a change major? Because I didn't want my dad seeing that I had changed my major from business to creative writing. And they said, yeah. They said, but you have to be very careful because you need to make sure you've got all of your credits done by the time you want to graduate. And they said 24 hours before you can switch your major and go back. So anyway, at the end of the day, my dad's not stupid. He was getting the report cards and saw that there were no more econ or finance classes, and he could tell something was up, and I eventually had to come clean. But at this point, a lot was happening in Hollywood. A lot of the bond traders were leaving New York and going to Hollywood to do film financing and everything. So my dad was reading about it in mainstream business magazines and thought, oh, my son's ahead of the curve. He's going to learn the film business, and then he'll get a graduate degree in the entrepreneurship program at USC. So I was like, sure, that's what I'll do. I just got through undergrad, and then that was it. I never looked back.
Right. And your dad was a Marine, correct?
Yeah, he was. The Marine Corps got him out of the south side of Chicago, and he went to college on the GI Bill.
And it seems that he has been a presence in your life, because after you declared this new major, you graduated and went to Paris in 95 and tried to write a novel.
Right, which had never been done, by the way. I don't know if you know this. No American has ever gone to Paris to write a novel. So I thought that was a pretty cool thing to do. And I got 3 chapters into it and I felt, I told myself, this is the most solitary profession in the world. I'm not interested in this. I shipped my laptop back home. I took all the money I had saved working in college and I traveled around Europe. Well, it wasn't that it was solitary. It was that I had this voice in the back of my head that I think a lot of us do that said, you know what? You may fail at this. What if you write a bad book? What if you don't get the book published? What if nobody likes it? Probably better not to even risk the embarrassment. Go travel, go have a good time, don't do this. And I traveled and I got this idea for a TV show. I wanted to do a travel show for 18 to 34 year olds to encourage younger people to travel outside the US. Don't wait till you're retired, go now. I thought travel made me a better American. I thought it made me more appreciative of how lucky I am to live in this country by seeing it from abroad. So I pitched public television. It worked out. I got my show on the air, did 23 episodes over a couple of seasons, and I got married. And on my honeymoon, my wife asked me, what would you regret on your deathbed never having done? And I blurted out, I didn't even know I said, writing a novel and getting it published. And she said, okay, when we get home, you need to start spending 2 hours protected time every day and make that dream come true. And that's how I wrote my first book.
That sounds like a great marriage and a great story, but I want to back up a minute. You're an English major and you decide to pitch a PBS travel show. How did that come up?
Well, so the way I accomplished it, so I was an English major. I'd studied film and television production at SC, and I had this idea. I thought it was a really good idea because basically the only person on TV at this time was Rick Steves doing his budget travel series, and then a wonderful guy who I just love named Bert Wolf, who did a cooking show. He's just the nicest guy, so funny, so smart. And so I was talking to my dad about this, and I said, I think I can get this off the ground. It's just, I don't have any experience to lean on other than I did some production assistant work for John Hughes, the filmmaker. And my dad said, listen, nobody's born with a beard. You have to hire a beard, meaning you have to hire people with more experience, and Hollywood's full of freelancers. So what you need to do is find people that would be perfect for this project. And when public television says, what have you done? You shift the attention to, well, let me tell you about my director. Look at how many Emmys this guy's got. So it was a good plan, and it worked in public television. What I ended up having to do is team up with a public television station. I actually funded the pilot on my own. Credit card applications were raining from the sky back then at 21.5% interest. So I put the entire pilot on my own credit cards. And I did a pilot, and we showed that to all the public television stations. They loved it. They signed up, or they didn't sign up. They said, if the rest of the shows look like this, we would be pleased to put this on our air. And I just went from station to station to station getting commitments. And then I went out and found underwriters for the show, and then went and did it.
Wow. And all those places you visited, I imagine, have somehow turned up in your novels. I mean, I know they have.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I want to go back then to some of the, how did you begin to research and know who to ask, say, when you started out with the Harvath series? You know, because I say that because you've just come from the PBS world, and we both know now how to pick up the phone and who to call, but
right.
At first it's a mystery. I had to talk about that because I think readers are curious.
Right. So I had a dear friend of my dad's who's like an uncle slash godfather who was a high-ranking person in the FBI. He'd retired recently from the FBI. He was a special agent in charge in New Jersey before he retired. He was a source. One of my neighbors, when I was in college, was recently out of the Army and was part of a very interesting intelligence group. The U.S. Army had gone through the Ranger battalions during the Cold War looking for Rangers who had grown up in households where German was spoken. And they gathered these guys up, taught them a ton of trade craft, and then dropped them in Berlin.
Detachment A, right?
Yeah. So what they were there for was if the Soviets ever overran the wall, they were there to conduct guerrilla warfare and slow them down. So they had weapons caches hidden in parks around Berlin with Krugerrands, radio sets plastered up behind walls in the basements of beer stubes in Berlin. So this buddy helped network me with some other people. And then the other person, and I don't know if you came across him during the filming of 12 Strong, there is one of the original plank owners of SEAL Team 6 named Harry Humphreys. Yeah. Who is a technical advisor on all Bruckheimer's movies. So Pirates of the Caribbean and all this kind of stuff. And a family friend introduced me to Harry, and Harry could not have been more generous with his time. There was another FBI agent who was terrific. So from this small pool of people, I networked through them and worked my way out. And over, boy, about 20 years, I have built a really good network of active and retired people in the military, law enforcement, and the intelligence communities.
What is it you like about that world? I mean, first of all, you sound like you've approached it like a reporter.
Yeah, to a certain degree. Sources and developing sources, sure.
Yeah. You're a sunny, happy guy. And Harvath is, he can get pretty... He drops into the bottle in Near Dark.
It's pretty dark for Harvath. What's interesting is my dad is the proudest Marine you will ever meet. My dad celebrates. We celebrate Marine Corps birthday every year, and my dad is just, he taught us the Marine Corps hymn when we were kids, and all from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. I mean, we could sing it as kids. So we were raised with this deep respect for the military. And then we've got my uncle slash godfather's at the FBI. But what's interesting is the Marine Corps in his military service was his ticket out of the South Side of Chicago. My grandfather was the first one born in the United States. So my dad's second generation, I'm third. And the dream of the Swedes was to elevate the family each generation so that each successive generation, it's the American dream, not just for the Swedes, but for everybody. Your kids go further than you did. And so my dad said, listen, I went through the military and I am going to use what I learned and the leg up that they gave me to push you and your brother even further out on the, you know, push the starting blocks of life even further down the track for you guys. He said, I want you to get out of college, take over my business, immediately go into the private sector. He said, we have so much respect for the police and for the military. I don't want you guys going and pursuing those careers. I want you immediately going into the private sector. That's how we move the Thor family forward. Well, it's funny because all my friends end up being cops and military people. So the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. My dad loved his time in the Marine Corps. I always joke around, I've got a friend who's an author who was a Navy SEAL. And I said, okay, you got it right. You did it in the right order. You were a Navy SEAL, then you're an author. I'm an author who wants to be a Navy SEAL. It's never going to happen, not at my age. So I also believe Stephen King in his book on writing had a great piece of advice, which is you should write what you love to read because that's where your passion is. You know, nobody decides I'm going to pick this genre to write in because I think I can make a lot of money there. And I take what Stephen King says and I extend it. Not only should you write what you love to read because that's where your passion is, but you have a PhD in that particular genre. You've been reading for years. You know why certain books did well and resonated with you and why other ones didn't. You've got a feeling for pace and tempo and the subjects they talk about and all this kind of stuff. So I've always, my parents were big readers, Doug, and I would grab their Ludlum books or their Le Carre books or their Clancy books the minute they set them down. The book couldn't even get cold on the coffee table before I'd snatch it up and start reading. So that's what I grew up reading and loving. And it just felt natural for me to choose this genre to write it.
Well, and it happens to coincide really with the biggest story post 1950 in America, which is, you know, say 9/11 and the constant combat we've been in.
Yeah.
Coming on 20 years. What can you say in the thriller that you can't say in a quote literary novel, or you can't say in a romance novel? How does it speak to us today?
Well, it's interesting because the critics tend to pay all the attention to the literary fiction. So commercial fiction, kind of what some of them call beach reads and stuff like that, they look down their noses at. I think for me, the appeal of what I write is that I give you an insider look into the worlds of people who technically don't exist. So our spies and our special operations people are our quiet professionals. They're not allowed to come out and beat their chests and say, look at me and look what I've done. I'm in the entertainment business. First and foremost, I'm a fiction writer. I want to give you the best escape possible, a white knuckle thrill ride. I want you turning those pages late into the night. Coming back to Stephen King, I would never say that what Stephen King writes is easy. I would never assume to know. I've never walked even, you know, across a front porch in Maine in his moccasins. So I can't say that what he does is easy. I do wonder sometimes what it's like for him to write what he does, because he makes up a certain amount of the rules as he goes. I can't. I actually have to use the tactics that special operators use. I have to use the tradecraft that people at the CIA use. I have to respect the diplomatic efforts and the way government works on a global basis and all that kind of stuff, how you get in and out of the White House and what the situation room is like and all that kind of stuff. So I feel there's a lot of rules, a lot of guardrails on what I do, but I've gotten to know that stuff very well over 2 decades, and I weave it into my stories, and I love to give people that great ride. And the icing on the cake for me is if when they've closed the book, they've actually learned something. Maybe they have some questions. You talk about the fact that we've been at war for 20 years. That's really impacting what I'm writing now, because I'm a voracious consumer of news. I look over the horizon, what's coming next. One of my biggest concerns as a citizen is that we have a war-weary public in the United States. And what would happen if the Russians, they took Crimea, and that got Russia kicked out of the G8, it's now the G7, because Putin annexed Crimea. What would happen if the Russians went after a small member of NATO? For those of you who don't know, there is an Article 5 in the NATO treaty that says an attack on one is an attack on all. And that Article 5 has only been exercised one time in NATO's history. We did it. The United States, after 9/11, we said, we've been attacked. We want all our NATO allies to come with us and to go to war in Afghanistan. So the backdrop for my thrillers now is that what would happen? Would the American public want to send their sons and daughters to Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, places that they maybe never have heard of, much less could find on a map? So if that was the case, if you had a president who didn't want to get dragged into a war in Europe, what kind of things might he allow an operative like mine, Scott Harvath, to do to prevent something like that from happening? So it's a part of kind of the geopolitical landscape that a lot of thriller writers are not looking at that for me is fun because it is so real and so possible. So I guess that's what I'm doing that's different from romance or from literary fiction, is that I'm looking at real world events or potential real world events and trying to fictionalize them.
So problem solving. So if we can't send 50,000 troops over a border, you can send 12 people like Scott Harvath.
Yeah, right? And you do the research, and I've learned fascinating things, like it'd be nearly impossible for us to move tanks and things like that out of Poland or Germany into the Baltics because the railroad gauge changes when you get up there. You actually have to move the tanks and put them on different flatbed trains, and those are sabotage points for Russian special forces. So there's all this neat stuff that people love to read my books and then go, oh, that can't be true. Thor made that up. I'm going to Google that. And they're like, oh my gosh, it is true. I'm not writing instruction manuals. I'm writing thrillers, page turners. But that is part of the fun, is when I hear from people going, I can't believe the stuff that you put in there. I thought for sure you made it up, and it's true. So I love putting all those little Easter eggs in the thrillers.
And you call that faction. You take that.
Correct. Where you don't know where the facts end and the fiction begins. Exactly.
So we're catching you right now, Brad, just on the promotional part of your life. But when this ends, you are, what happens?
It's back to writing full time. In fact, this book, we pushed it off by a month. We actually had an earlier release date in June, and we delayed it by a month because we were hoping that I could be out on the road, that we'd get coronavirus under control and I could go out, because I love to go on the road. I love to go to events like this, to go to bookstores and things like that. And so we pushed it off. This is actually a later release for me than normal. So when all of the publicity and the virtual events end, I'm back at my desk, seat of pants, seat of chair, Jack London Club, going after inspiration on a daily basis in writing away on the new Scott Harvath.
How long will it take you to draft the first, you know?
I always say, how long is a piece of string? Each book is different. It depends on how much research. I always pick a topic that I'm interested in learning more about that I can weave into the story. That's the rocket fuel that gets me through the year of writing. But each book is different. Some books move faster, some books move slower. So they're like kids. They each have their own individual personalities.
Well, listen, we hope to see you in person someday with a new novel. Sure. And thank you so much for being our guest. And thank you for supporting NWS by being here. It really means a lot.
It's my pleasure. And it's been a great time. And I want to thank all of the viewers tonight. And I look forward to making it up to Traverse City to be able to see you all in person. Maybe next year. Wouldn't that be great?
It would be. All right. Thank you.
That was Brad Thor talking with Doug Stanton. Brad's latest book is Near Dark. In the first half of the program, we heard from Karen Dion talking with Cynthia Canty. Karen's latest novel is The Wicked Sister. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Milcarrick.